To order. And welcome, everyone. We're going to start out with a work session, and we have two bills to hear today. So, Representative Kitts, we have, well, I'll tell the committee first. We have LC 1365, which deals with interior design. We're going to be introducing this as a committee bill, and so we will then, after it is a committee bill, we will be working on it. And it is in your packet here and has to do with trying to protect the profession of interior design because it is a four-year degree, and so that's what this bill is about. Representative Kitts.
Madam Chair, I move that LC 1365 be introduced as a committee bill.
Representative Kitts has moved that we introduce LC 1365 as a committee bill. Is there discussion? Seeing none, is there objection? Seeing none, so ordered. I'm going to open a public hearing on House Bill 2166. And we'll have the staff read the summary.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. House Bill 2166 allows eligible taxpayer who claims farm worker housing tax credit to transfer all of the credit to other taxpayer, allows the application for farm worker housing tax credit approval to be filed within 6 months of start of farm worker housing project, and expands the definition of farm worker housing project to include acquisition of housing. And this legislation applies to tax years beginning on or after January 1, 2004. You'll see you have a dash one amendments that the proponents have asked for in your packet.
Okay, our first witness. You'll be over 50 miles. Nobody. Okay. Is Lynn Parton? Come forward, please.
Would it be all right if you could name the people as well at the same time?
Absolutely.
Thank you.
This is Housing and Community Services.
Yes.
Okay. Chair Close. Members of the committee, I appreciate the opportunity to be here today. For the record, my name is Lynn Parton. I'm actually wearing several hats. I am here in my position as farm worker programs representative at the Housing and Community Services Department. A couple of other people associated with the department were our advisory body. The State Housing Council were unable to be here because that body is meeting today. Bob Repine, the director, had hoped to be at this hearing, and Buzz Ortiz, who is a member of the State Housing Council, both expressed their regrets that they were unable to be here personally today. Buzz was concerned about there being a quorum at the Housing Council if he didn't appear here, and Bob definitely had to be there. So they both extend their regrets. They both support this bill, I would like to add. Someone else who couldn't be here is Don Schellenberg from the Oregon Farm Bureau, but he authorized me to let you know that they are in full support of this bill as well. We will explain a little bit more about the background of this tax credit and the work of the Farm Worker Housing Task Force during the 2000, after the 1999 session. It was a very diverse body of farm worker representatives of the agricultural industry brought together under the co-chairmanship of then Senator Castillo, and the chair on the House side was then Representative Kevin Mannix. And there were 18 recommendations that came out of that group, all of which were unanimous. And a lot of those got worked into the 2001 session as improvements to the Farm Worker Housing Tax Credit, which is the subject of this bill. And some of those included $3.3 million a year in eligible costs for the credits, more than doubling to $7.5 million. It used to be 30% of the eligible costs could be taken. In 2001, that became 50%. And it did clarify that you could transfer the credits, which was not really clear in statute before, but it put a ceiling of 80% for the transferability of that, meaning that some of those credits would be lost. So following the after the Farm Worker Housing Task Force completed its report in December of 2000, its tasks were officially over and it disbanded, but people thought that it would be a good idea to have another body like that kind of follow up and keep in the loop as the regulations were written for some of the other things like the Farm Worker Housing Development Account and so forth. So we've used the Farm Worker Housing Facilitation Team as an advisory body as well. So there's sort of another one I'm here representing. And we did vet this proposal, passed them as a legislative concept, and there was wide support there as well. So I just want to let you know there is a lot of support out there, and I'm kind of wearing all of those hats here. We have also been in conversation with revenue, and I can talk about that in a couple minutes. First, I want to talk about what the bill actually does. As Megan said, first the bill would add, actually it clarifies that acquisition counts. So for instance, if somebody wanted to get a modular home and put it on a piece of property, that would clearly count as housing as opposed to just having to do a stick build on the property from the first place. Then also the grace period, sometimes people don't actually know about these credits. A lot of growers are not in the housing business. They're in the agricultural industry, and this is very much a sideline to them. And we are trying to avoid the situation of gotcha if they stick a shovel in the ground and then they find out about the credits. Obviously, the whole idea of having tax credits is to incent rather than reward. So we're not interested in passing out credits for things that were built years ago, but we did think it was appropriate to have a grace period, and it is very consistent with some of our other housing resource tools that we have on our housing development side. And then probably the most important thing the bill does is to eliminate the ceiling on the amount of credits that can be transferred. In the majority, I shouldn't say the majority of the applications, but the financial value, the most financial value went to situations where there were nonprofits developing farm worker housing in community-based settings. And in these cases, they can't take the credit themselves. So if they can only transfer 80% of the credit, then the rest of it is just kind of left laying on the table, which is a waste. So eliminating the ceiling would enable the value of the credits to be fully maximized, and we think that's really important. The Department of Revenue has some, I spoke with Deborah Buchanan yesterday. She's another person I'm sort of representing here. From Department of Revenue, and she's at House Revenue down the hall, so she couldn't be here either, but she authorized me to represent on their behalf that they have some technical amendments. They're in support of what the bill is doing, but they have some technical amendments that they would like to see, but that what their preference would be is for this bill to come out of this committee today, and it has a subsequent referral to revenue, so we could work on that together. We don't have a problem with what they're trying to do. It's just clarifying technical stuff that really doesn't have to do with the bill. It has to do with the underlying statute. Actually, we're on the same page about currently contributor, for instance, really doesn't specify the distinctions between developer and investor, which we think it would be good to clarify. So we don't have any problem with what they're asking or the way that they're proposing that we go about it. So should I address the Dash 1 amendment at this point? Or
let's go to questions
okay. First.
I just wanted to ask you, you've got several costs listed in Section 1C. Eligible costs include finance costs. You've added acquisition costs, construction costs. Can you be a little more clear on what acquisition costs are, how they differ from finance costs?
Madam Chair, yes. Specifically, we're trying to indicate it's not that you couldn't have finance costs on an acquisition. Like you might have a bank loan to purchase a manufactured dwelling. In that case, you might have both. But we're just trying to indicate that in an acquisition, you're purchasing a commodity in the market and bringing it there as opposed to doing construction on site. And we just are trying to be as flexible as possible, clarifying that both of those situations are eligible projects for this tax credit.
Okay. Other questions? Representative Gallegos.
Yes. In cases where we're issuing a credit, many times the farmers, is there a stipulation between when the farmer can charge rent or monitoring that? Because in some cases they're getting rent back, which is, and a credit. Is this where farm workers provide it at no cost and get the tax credit for providing it, or?
Chair Close, Representative Gallegos, in the vast bulk of the grower housing, we see no rent charge whatsoever. The community-based housing usually does have rents, and we ask about those in the application. They need to let us know, are they keeping them at 50%? Are they, who are they serving, and what are they charging for their rents? But in virtually none of the on-farm housing do we see rent being charged with us giving out tax credits.
Is there a monitoring process for that at all?
Chair Close, Representative Gallegos, what happens is that after there's an interesting relationship, three-way relationship on these between OROSHA, housing, and the Department of Revenue. And so after we approve the credits and get the certificates of occupancy, then it is up to the it is up to whoever got the tax credits to certify compliance with general things like, you know, it's still being used as farm worker housing, which they have to have it used as for 10 years unless they get a waiver after 5 years and so forth. So basically they say, you know, everything that we promised we're going to do, we're still doing. And so they have to certify that to revenue every year. So the long answer is yes, revenue takes care of it. The short answer is no, we don't.
Okay. Representative
Kitts. Thank you for being here today. I had a question regarding tax credits. I get a little nervous about tax credits. I mean, I'm a big proponent of tax credits. However, it's my understanding that according to an H-1A visa, which is what a lot of these farm workers are on when they come and do the seasonal rotation, migrant workers, a lot of them, it's required of the farmer that they provide housing. Is that not true?
Chair Close, Representative Kitts, yes. I believe you're talking about H-2A, and this may be something Peter can speak to better, but I did talk to Mary Lewis at the Employment Department, and she said there are only 6 people in the whole state who are here under that program since J. Frank Schmidt and Son got out of that. And so we think it's extremely unlikely, just if you look at the odds, that we would be... it's a question we haven't asked before, and if you wanted us to ask it, it's, you know, possibly an amendment we could entertain, but it just seems very unlikely given how few overall units this program touches out of the total population of farm workers in the state.
Yeah, if I could, I mean, just from my knowledge, and I think it'd be beneficial for the committee to know that as well, I just would hate to provide tax credits for something that was required.
Yes, I understand.
So that's my only concern. Well,
yeah, okay.
Representative Gerard.
Quite often in communities that approve sites for dwellings that qualify, after a period of time, those areas can actually become a negative to the community. Is there any provision that allows for inspections or routine evaluations if the, as an example, if you had multiple mobile homes in an area receiving these credits, and a couple years goes by and no one is monitoring whether these are still meeting standards, is there anything in the provision that covers that occurring?
Chair Close, Representative Gerard, yes, there is a whole continuum of review that goes on in the community development area. most of the time, the tax credits that we put out on these units will not be the only thing that comes out of our department. So, for instance, if they have home federal dollars in there, those are inspected every year. If they have low-income housing tax credits, another federal program, those are inspected every 3 years. If they're on farm, they're inspected if they're considered a labor camp, which basically almost anything is. If you've got five or more unrelated people, that's a labor camp, then OROSHA inspects.
Representative Rosenbaum.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Good morning. I just wanted to clarify and then ask a question. I served on this committee last session, and we did hear very compelling testimony about the need to do something to increase the availability of farm worker housing and also try to upgrade the abysmal conditions of some of the housing that was already in place. And so the recommendations that included this bill were really a response to a need that we couldn't even begin to fill. I guess what I wanted to ask you about, though, is I think it might not be clear that the housing units that this credit would apply to are not just ones that a farmer would build on his own property. We're talking about also community development corporations, the Farm Worker Housing Development Corporation, whatever it's called, who build housing that would be available to people on an ongoing basis, not just associated with one particular farm. Is that the case?
Chair Close, Representative Rosenbaum, that's right on the money. And the vast bulk of these tax credits, again, not in the number of applications necessarily, but certainly in the financial value of the credits, they go to exactly those kinds of units. And they have all kinds of services. And Peter Hanley's organization is a consultant to a huge number of those, and he might want to talk a little bit when I give him a chance about some of the things they do, because they do wonderful things in terms of having all kinds of programs and services. And I'll let him toot his own horn a little bit more. But no, some of those are wonderful, wonderful projects.
Sure. Representative Gallegos.
Yeah, I do appreciate you coming to me the other day and giving me a heads up on this. And I know we talked about Campo Azul in Washington County. And the question occurred to me, is Campo Azul currently receiving tax credits? I mean, clearly that's a deplorable situation. I'm wondering if that existing camp might have, or ones like it, have existing tax credits that they're receiving. And people are paying rent, and it's in horrible, horrible condition.
Chair Close, Representative Gallegos, Peter would like me to defer to him on this. The short answer is I certainly don't think so. We only got the program as of this year, and so our experience of it goes back 1 year. And so I've been running the program for 2002, and I can certainly tell you they didn't get any from us. But I can't believe they've got any from OROSHA either, but I will certainly find out.
My name is Peter Hanley. I'm Executive Director of CASA of Oregon. We've recently been asked to consult on the Campo Azul project. Washington County has an option to purchase the camp, which expires today. And so we've been looking at the possibility of either having them extend that or having someone else step in their shoes and basically take over that option. It would be our intention to seek farm worker tax credits to fix that camp up, but in no way would it look anything like it does now.
No, I just want a clarification that a farm like that is not receiving tax credits. Clearly there's no monitoring, or I mean it is getting attention because of the issue, but there are people paying rent. It's a profit center, mm-hmm. and I'm sure. hoping that that situation does not exist where they would receive credits.
Chair Close,
make money.
I'm sorry. Chair Close, Representative Gallegos, it is certainly not my understanding that they are receiving tax credits. And I did follow up with a call to David Sparks at OROSHA about your other question about what their status was with regard to enforcement issues in the camp. So,
go ahead.
Okay. Good morning. My name is Peter Hanley. I'm Executive Director of...
I'm going to have to stop you. Representative Schaffler had one last question.
Okay. Thank you. I'm neither an enemy nor a friend of tax credits. If we're getting some value back for them that's at least equivalent to what we're handing out, great. If we aren't, well, then I don't want them. That's pretty simple philosophy. Do you feel, in your experience and your knowledge, that this bill will markedly, visibly improve the living conditions of farm workers and their families? That's all I really want to know about it.
Chair Close, Representative Schaffler, that is my belief, yes.
Peter?
Good morning. Once again, my name is Peter Hanley. I'm Executive Director of CASA of Oregon. We are a community-based nonprofit community development corporation based out of Newburgh. I also served on the Farm Worker Housing Task Force, the Interim Task Force, in 1999, and am currently assisting on the Farm Worker Housing Facilitation Team, which was included as one of the provisions in one of the bills passed last session. We provide assistance primarily to community development corporations and housing authorities for the construction and or rehabilitation of farm worker housing. To date, we've built approximately 19 projects in communities throughout the state, in Klamath Falls, Gresham, Cornelius, Ontario, Oregon, and all around the state. We're providing services to these organizations, not just for the development of the housing, but also we assist in the development of their capacity to own and operate the housing in the long term. So we want to make sure these units are operated in a manner that's going to make it an asset to the community. We want to make sure that our reputation is protected as well, so when we go into the next community, we can point to the first project that we ever did and say, look at this project. It doesn't look any different than any market-based project, and in a lot of instances, it looks better than some of those projects. Most of our work has been done in the construction of in-town housing, though we have done a number of rehabilitation of labor camps throughout the state. To address one of the concerns earlier about are we making sure that these projects are inspected on an ongoing basis, the answer is yes, or OSHA is inspecting these as part of the farm worker tax credit. In the statute, it requires that if a farmer is going to do a rehab or new construction, that they need to be certified as a labor camp, and so that basically puts them into the review process that OSHA has established. Most of the farm workers that we work with are they're low income, very low income, which is 50% or below of median income, typically anywhere between $8,000 and $13,000. This tax credit has been phenomenal in helping us attract a lot of federal money, and private and local money, so it's really leveraged a lot of dollars out there in the community. We estimated that 90% of the folks living in the units are very low income, and many of them are at poverty level. Poverty level for a family of five, I believe, is about $9,000 at this time. Some might ask, where did this provision of 80% transferability come from? And I was on the task force. I actually chaired the finance work group that came up with the financial recommendations, and without naming names, this proposal, unless somebody asks me to name names, then I'll name it, but this proposal was so that a portion of the tax credit would remain with the farmer so that the farmer wasn't just transferring the whole thing. I think at the time, and I know we have one other task force member here that might remember better than I, but at the time, I think we just kind of scratched our head and said, okay, well, that's fine. Well, if I'd had my thinking cap on, I would have realized that, well, for the nonprofits and the housing authorities that are developing these, retaining 20% of a tax credit is not going to assist them in any way. And so I think once we're able to, if this bill passes, we're going to see some additional funds that will be able to provide additional units for farm worker housing. I have no doubts about that. It's going to correct some of the unintended consequences of I think it was 3173, House bill last year or last session. So with that, I would urge you to pass this, and I would answer any questions at this time.
Representative Garrard.
Just a brief statement that one of the areas that this program has in the past built these units is Klamath Falls, and I happen to serve on the board of SoCo Development in Klamath, which has worked with Peter and brought these projects to fruition. And I can only compliment CASA and let the committee know that you did everything you said you would do, and you did it on time, and it was a very good experience, and you benefited the people, especially the poorer people, the farm workers. Unfortunately, after we built all the housing, we lost the jobs. But nonetheless, you did your job well, and the committee should be aware of that. Thank you.
Thanks.
Okay. Further questions? Seeing none, thank you so much.
Chair Close, should I address the dash one while I'm up here?
Well, let's,
should I come
I think
back
I'll
up?
Call you back if you
okay.
can. Can you stay?
Absolutely.
Okay. I think I'll go to Noreen Goplin and John McCullough, if you could come up as a panel in the interest of time. And John is with the Fruit Growers, and Noreen is with Lutheran Advocacy Ministry of Oregon. Welcome.
Representative Close and members of the committee, my name is Noreen Goplin, and I'm the director of Lutheran Advocacy Ministry of Oregon. I've also been very involved in studies and research about unregistered labor camps in the area. I served on the Joint Legislative Task Force on Housing. And when I wrote this at 4 o'clock this morning, I forgot I also serve on the Subcommittee for Farm Worker Housing in Housing and Community Services. I'd like to address two points of the bill that you're looking at. One is the transfer of the housing tax credit. And just very briefly to say that it is very important in terms of reducing the overall project cost for a nonprofit or for a grower to be able to transfer that tax credit to the financial entity. For the nonprofit, because they have no interest or utilization of the tax credit. For the grower, it provides the ability at a time when their own profitability is very limited and where they're actually operating from hope. That's one of the conditions of being in farming, that hope for good seasons, good crops, and fair prices. And for many of the farmers who are providing housing and meeting it for the workers who they employ, they're in parts of agriculture which is very tenuous at this point. So for their moving out into the future for improved housing, rehabilitation, or new housing, it's important to give them adequate tools as well as they work with financial entities. But I'd rather spend more of my time talking about the acquisition process. We've watched the development of farm worker housing projects with great appreciation and amazement. The process of acquiring a feasible project site, developing the project details, meeting the requirements of local jurisdictions and the state, and securing the public's trust through an extensive hearing process is formidable. And it's costly. Because of our interest, we have explored very deeply the potential of becoming a provider. And in doing that, have spent a considerable amount of time with Catholic Charities, which has moved forward as a faith community to provide for farm worker housing and other community housing. We deeply appreciate the work undertaken by our colleagues, Catholic Charities. And through their experience, we're aware of the challenges and the cost and the extensive process that results in the acquisition and pre-construction development of the property. The significance of being able to include some of those acquisition costs as eligible under the tax credit umbrella is necessary to the future development of farm worker housing. While we currently don't envision, as a faith community, to become a provider of farm worker housing, we stand as advocates for those who do, and the changes before you in House Bill 2166 provide a significant change, in our view, that would encourage the development of some of the most desperately needed housing in Oregon. Thank you.
John McCulley.
Good morning, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is John McCulley. I'm representing the tree fruit growers, which are the pear, apple, and cherry growers, primarily in Hood River, Wasco County, Milton Freewater area, and Umatilla County, and Jackson County. We're here in support of House Bill 2166. We think that there are some very important changes contained in this bill to the current farm worker housing tax credit law. I appreciated Representative Rosenbaum a reference to the bills that passed last session. That was a monumental effort on behalf of this committee at that time, and I think the advocates for better housing for farm workers. The history of this farm worker tax credit goes back to the 1989 session when it was first enacted. It had significant review in the 1995 session and again last session. We believe that all of the scrutiny that's been applied to this tax credit shows that it's meeting a very important public purpose of incenting a provision of adequate housing for farm workers, and it's a very important program. I do want to express appreciation to Director Reeve Pine and Lynn Parton for the work they have done in the Housing and Community Services Department on this project. They have really dedicated themselves to making this program work. I want to just comment on a specific part of the bill. We haven't spent a lot of time on the grace period, but we think that's an important one in the agriculture community. And it largely has to do with the variability in income and variability of equipment that may occur during a farming operation. There may be times of the year when money is available and a project may get started with the long-term goal of maybe in 5 years completing a housing project. So somebody may put electrical to a site, they may pour a foundation in hopes that in a few years they can actually begin real construction. And then a check arrives that I got more for my fruit than I was expecting, and all of a sudden now I can complete this housing project. Under the current law, the person would not be eligible to apply for the credit. We think it's important that there be a recognition that these kinds of variances do happen in agriculture, and this 6-month grace period would facilitate that. In all, we think this is a very important piece of legislation and encourage your positive recommendation to the Revenue Committee to pass this bill.
Thank you very much. Appreciate your testimony. That concludes our testimony on this bill. I'd like to call Lynn back up to talk about the amendment. Committee, you should have that in your packet, and it's just adding a line on page 2, correct?
Madam Chair, again, for the record, my name is Lynn Parton, and Housing and Community Services Department. One thing that I was noticing when I was looking through this bill, if you look at the top of page 2 of House Bill 2166, lines 7 through 10, it says, by the taxpayer. It was added in at legislative council twice. And the problem with the way that this comes out is that it really doesn't contemplate the bulk of our situations. As I said, in most of the financial value of the tax credits that we put out in 2002 went to nonprofit developers who then sold the credits. And they are not taxpayers, so under general definition. So this clarifies that a taxpayer would include a nonprofit corporation or other person not subject to tax. So basically, it just contemplates now outright that a situation where there is a nonprofit developer selling the credits, that the statute actually covers that.
Questions for Lynn on the amendment? Okay, thank you
so much.
Okay, I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 2166, and I'm going to open a work session on House Bill 2166. Representative Garrard.
Madam Chair, I would move that House Bill 2166 with the dash one amendment.
We have to move the dash one.
You just want a motion on the amendment first?
On the amendment.
Correct. Then I would move that we move the dash one amendment on House Bill 2166 with a...
Representative Garrard has moved the dash one amendment to be put into House Bill 2166. Is there discussion? Is there objection? Okay. Hearing none, so ordered. Representative Garrard.
Madam Chair, I would now move that House Bill 2166 be referred to the Revenue Committee with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Garrard has moved House Bill 2166 as amended to the Revenue Committee, House Revenue Committee with a due pass recommendation. Is there a discussion? Hearing none, the clerk will call the roll.
Representative Gallegos?
Aye.
Representative Garrard?
Aye.
Representative Brinkley?
Excuse.
Representative Schaffler?
Aye.
Representative Kitts?
Aye.
Representative Rosenbaum?
Aye.
Chair Close?
Votes aye.
Motion carries. And thank you all for your excellent testimony. We're going to close the work session on House Bill 2166. Shuffle our papers. I'm going to open a public hearing on House Bill 2341. And Megan, could you please tell us about this bill?
Sure. A very brief explanation of House Bill 2341, Madam Chair, members of the committee, is that it revises the requirements and procedures for public contracting, and it specifies the dates when those provisions become operative. It does have a declared emergency effective on passage, and you'll see that it'll be explained that this is a rewrite of RS 279, and they break it up into three chapters, RS 279A, B, and C. And it does have a subsequent referral to Ways and Means. Thank you.
Okay, are we bringing Jessica up first? This goes to the court.
Okay, I'm going to call Jessica Harris forward from AGC and Sue Clobber-Pants. Is that correct? I'm sorry. City of Portland. And Representative Gerard is going to join.
Madam Chair, this...
Excuse me, before we start, I guess we're going to include Dugan Petty in this group. Is that correct? All right. So we'll have to pull up a chair.
I'll get out of your book.
Thank you.
Good morning, Madam Chair. I'm State Representative Bill Gerard, District 56, Klamath Falls. House Bill 2341 is a rewrite of ORS 279, the Public Contracting Code. I've already lost my pencil, which I was going to use to indicate... Thank you. Oh, look at that. The state of Oregon, we buy pencils and we buy lamps and microphones, build roads and build buildings, all with the same process. There's no way you can do that without causing a certain amount of confusion, confliction, and some amount of questions. At the end of the last legislative session, Speaker Mark Simmons asked me to chair a committee that had already been in existence for 4.5 years, and that was a committee to rewrite ORS 279. I sit before you today as chair of that interim workforce group on House Bill 279. During the past 8 months, this group has held over 16 formal meetings. Over 200 people have worked on this bill. Obviously, as you look at this bill, it's great to maybe take a look at it, read it before you go to bed at night, that kind of thing. Every known group that was involved in this, and you can imagine the number of different groups that are involved with doing business with not only the state of Oregon, but any municipality within the state. We worked with everyone who came forth. Critical to the process was a clear understanding by all the individuals that this was simply basically a housekeeping bill that had long been overdue. This bill was drafted as close to the existing language of ORS 279 as we could get it, and the result is what is before you today. Hundreds of people, thousands of hours of hard work, and they have produced this document. And I'm very proud of the people who worked so diligently and hard to prepare this document, because it's badly needed in the state of Oregon. Thank you.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, if I may, for the record, my name is Jessica Harris. I'm here today in two capacities. First, as the representative for Associated General Contractors in Oregon, but more importantly this morning as a co-chair of the stakeholder group that worked long and hard on this effort. First, I'd like to take a moment and thank Representative Girard for his leadership in moving this issue forward and his direction to us to go and get this done. I can tell you that after over several years and hours of work that we are ecstatic to be here and with this bill in front of you. I appreciate, Madam Chair, members of the committee, your willingness to hear this bill and delve into a very exciting area of law. Before you are three different documents, the first of which is the 2001-2002 interim report on the House Work Group on Public Contracting Law. This report was prepared by Carol Filsinger with committee services and represents the work of the interim committee. I'm not going to walk you through this report at this time, but essentially this will provide for you a kind of sense of the process, the substance, who was involved, how many meetings, how much paper, et cetera, was generated in this effort. We're all about helping the timber company stay in business, and so we've used lots of paper in this process. We're excited about that. Second, there is a section-by-section analysis to House Bill 2341 designed to kind of walk you through the different sections and provide a sense of what this bill does. We will, as best we can, provide you a sense of what's new here, what's different, and why what's different is different. As Representative Girard indicated, we have done our level best and remain committed to continuing to do our best to, in the areas where there is controversy, resolve it so that we do not change the intent of current law. And the members of the co-chairs that sit beside me and the members of the task group remain committed to that effort. So to the extent that we didn't get there yet, this is a work in progress. Finally, you'll see in front of you an amendment, the language that we've submitted to Legislative Council for the First Amendment, the Second Amendment, and the progress on the Third Amendment to House Bill 2341. There are substantial changes to the current draft necessary to keep pace with the work group process, and we are undergoing efforts to make those changes happen. So with that, I'm going to stop talking for a moment and turn this over to Sue Clevertons to kind of walk through how the committee process works.
Chair Close, members of the committee, thank you for the opportunity to appear before you today regarding this bill on public procurement. For the record, I am Sue Clevertons, Director of the Bureau of Purchases for the City of Portland, but as Jessica indicated, that's not the hat I'm wearing today. I am appearing before you as one of the three co-chairs for this ORS 279 rewrite task group. My job this morning, I got the easy part, because my job this morning is to just briefly review the history of how we got up to the last year, what's happened during the last 12 to 13 months, and then review with you a little bit of our efforts to ensure an inclusive and complete process. The history leading up to the last year, as it's already been referenced, the review of the public contracting law began in earnest in 1997-98 interim, when the House Agency Streamlining Committee appointed a subcommittee to review public contracting law, or as we lovingly call it, ORS 279. That subcommittee convened a group of interested parties to identify and resolve problems surrounding the ORS. The group proposed four consensus measures for the 99 legislative consideration. The only measure that didn't pass was the formation of a Public Purchasing and Contracting Advisory Committee to review ORS 279. During the next interim, 99-2000, the House Committee on Agency Performance and Operations formed another subcommittee. This is sort of an issue that hasn't gone away, no matter how hard people tried to ignore it. So the subcommittee was continued to review ORS 279. The process was similar to the 98 interim effort, with a large group of stakeholders coming together reporting consensus recommendations back to the legislative committee. The interim committee filed three measures for the 2001 legislative session, and at that time two of those passed, one on subcontractor disclosure, and the other one was the continuing review of ORS 279. So that now brings us to the 2001 House of Representatives, when they unanimously approved House Resolution 1, urging the Speaker of the House of Representatives to assign the task of continuing the work of the public contracting law revision. House Work Group on Public Contracting Law, chaired by Representative Girard, was appointed. And in November 2001, the chair asked for a group of stakeholders to brainstorm a list of issues. That half-day brainstorming session generated 20 broad themes in response to the question of what are the key concepts for change in the new statute guiding public procurement in Oregon. The bulk of the suggestions, however, related to clarifying, streamlining, simplifying, and modernizing public contracting statutes. On the need for improvements, everyone involved had total consensus. That legislative work group met again in December 2001 to hear the results of the brainstorming session, appoint a stakeholder working group, and provide direction to that group. Now, the structure, how did this all work? The legislative work group approved an operating structure consisting of themselves, the legislative work group, which was to provide policy guidance and feedback to a larger stakeholder group. For lack of a better name, we called ourselves the Task Group on ORS 279. Not exactly catchy, but it sort of indicated what we were doing. The task group was chaired by the three people you have here now, myself, Jessica Harris from AGC, and Dugan Petty from the Department of Administrative Services. That task group then in turn identified smaller issue groups to work on very specific topics within the ORS 279. The task group met monthly during the last year to hear and validate the progress of the smaller issue groups. When consensus was reached on a particular topic, then that was passed on to a drafting team, and that drafting team would work to construct recommended legal language that would then come back to the task group for approval. The task group, I think I counted 16 meetings between, and I think that includes one last month, so between January 2002 and January 2003, that larger task group met 17 times. We began, when we were formed in 2002, by coming to consensus on what our goal was, what did we want to accomplish, specific expectations, what were we going to get done, guiding principles and ground rules. The goal was pretty straightforward. It was to replace ORS 279 with an effective, simplified procurement code developed in collaboration with stakeholders during the 2003 legislative session. The expectations picked up on some of those themes. We wanted to involve all interested stakeholders in both the dialogue and the rewrite. We wanted to utilize a collaborative process to achieve consensus. We wanted to base our work on the brainstorming issues that we had derived initially, develop the legislative concept draft that would provide an end-to-end procurement code and not just look at one particular piece, and then report back progress reports and recommendations to the legislative work group. Now, guiding principles, we spent some time on that. That's not usually the fun part of the work, but we thought it was very important that everyone be brought along with the same expectations and understandings. So number one, our first expectation and guiding principle was to simplify the process. We didn't want to come out with a new statute that was even more complicated and convoluted than what we were already trying to work with. Number two, we wanted to standardize the process except where the outcomes might be compromised. To me, that means going back to simplification so that everyone can understand what the process is. Based on the previous work in the previous interims, we realized that we needed to separate the public works construction from other procurement activities. As it was indicated earlier, the current law says that you buy pens or pencils the same way you build roads. That's very difficult. And so we decided that we would make changes to the general procurements, yes, pens and pencils, that sort of thing, while maintaining sort of an envelope, if you will, around public improvements, and make changes to public improvement side only as time and consensus allowed. So that's a key point to all of this, is that throughout the entire process, we would only make substantive changes in the public improvement contracting only when full consensus could be achieved. And the group deferred to maintaining current law whenever policy decisions were needed or where controversy arose.
This entire effort, this House bill you have before you today, is intended to be policy neutral, simplify and streamline while making no major policy changes in the law. We've already talked about that the guiding principles included consensus. We decided we'd use best practices in through either work from other states and local governments, American Bar Association. We'd use a risk-based approach. Controls in the law should be commensurate with the risk. That's not necessarily the case in the current ORS. We wanted to be oriented to public accountability, revise the statute to eliminate conflicting provisions, improve, streamline, simplify. Some of these same themes are coming up over and over again. We look for diversity in representation and perspective, and we valued that because that meant if we could reach consensus with a diverse group, that then we were well on our way to reaching a bill that we could all agree to. And then we also wanted, particularly in the public procurement side, we wanted to be forward-facing and position all of us in a place that was that would make procurement solutions feasible and consistent with both today and tomorrow's marketplace. The bottom line, we tried to make proposed changes workable for the realities of public contracting managers and the private sector while being policy neutral. As I indicated, the task group operated with many, many small topic groups. They were formed on different topics for procurement, public improvement, and overarching topics such as definitions, which is always very difficult in these bills, intergovernmental relations, and contract preferences. The various topic groups and the drafting team met weekly. There's a theme here. We met a lot. Not only did we produce a lot of paper, this has been an incredible effort by a lot of people. This is not the quickest or the easiest structure, but I believe it was probably the most inclusive structure possible given the constraints of travel and workload we all share. Now let me just talk briefly about outreach and stakeholder input. As I indicated on the topic groups, there were various topic groups on everything from information technology purchases clear through the full range. We made an attempt to reach out to both private and public participants who had interest in a particular area. I know Dugan, Jessica, and myself all made individual phone calls, particularly to vendors in the different areas, in an attempt to get everyone to this table. As the task group got closer to a work product and we actually knew what this thing was starting to look like, we started to share with existing groups where we were headed and what we expected the outcome to be. The Capital Club presentation in September was hosted by the Associated General Contractors. We held a luncheon and a briefing with them. October and November, we held three vendor forums in the Salem and Portland area, and the purpose of those forums was to notify firms who compete for government contracts of what was happening. I know in the Portland area, we sent out notice of the vendor forums to everyone that we have in the city's list, and that's over 8,000 vendors were notified of the forum in Portland.
So could I ask you the type of numbers that you had from the vendor forum and also from the Capital Club presentation?
Capital Club.
Madam Chair, if I may, Justin Harris, again from AGC. We had about 25 people attend that meeting. We had several people who responded with interest, and we followed up with them. But we did mail the entire Capital Club and invite them all to attend.
Okay. Madam Chair, on the vendor forums, I've seen different numbers. When I counted the sign-in sheets, I came to approximately 100 participants. I've seen other numbers that were at around 80. So, thank you.
I think in Salem we had about 80 of the two presentations we did.
And then the other type of outreach we did was to the Oregon Public Purchasing Association. There was a full-day briefing where members of the task group provided briefing and also it took feedback, and that happened in October, and there were about 80 public purchasing folks represented there. Overall, we estimate that nearly 200 individuals participated in at least one topic group
task group meeting, supplier briefing forum, and then a core of faithful participants organized and attended all of the other meetings that we talked about. In summary, as a co-chair, I want to state that I view this bill as a compromise effort. Our priority was to produce a bill that was policy neutral while still moving us forward to a modern procurement orientation and maintaining the long-recognized political history in the area of public improvements. There's still much work to be done outside this bill, policy decisions that we didn't tackle because there was no consensus, whether it's issues such as local preferences, how to handle personal service contracts, changes to the threshold value of what size contract needs full advertisement. There's a long list of policy issues that's still out there, and we're not pretending to have addressed those. Our emphasis was on the basic core functions of public improvement, and we think this bill is a major improvement from the existing ORS 279. Thank you.
Madam Chairman, members of the committee, thank you for giving us the opportunity to testify this morning. My name is Dugan Petty. I'm the Deputy Administrator with the Procurement, Fleet, and Surplus Services Division of the Department of Administrative Services. I'm here today as one of the three and third co-chair of this task group. We also have with us today two attorneys from the Department of Justice that worked with us faithfully on this effort. Bill Nestle, who was our chair of the drafting team, who has been working feverishly on drafting language around this to then transmit back to the task group for approval and take into consideration the task group comments. And Dana Anderson. And Dana has been working really with the 279C side primarily, and Jessica on the 279C. And when I refer to 279C, it generally means the public improvement, public works. My part of this presentation may not be quite as easy as Sue's. It occurs to me that if this were the easy part, we wouldn't be here at all today, because I get to describe kind of from a 30,000-foot level ORS 279 as it currently exists. And I'm going to give it my best shot, but it is fairly complicated. And I want to start out by simply saying that it's broad in scope. Not only does it guide state agencies, or at least many state agencies, on public procurement and how they behave in this arena of public procurement, but also it describes all public agencies, school districts. It addresses counties, cities, special districts. So it's very broad in scope of coverage. Not all states have that approach. Some states have statute that guide just their state agency procurement, but don't guide all public agencies. In Oregon, we guide all public agencies. So the diversity of the stakeholders, and when you think about the size of public agency involved, from large public agencies like the City of Portland or Multnomah County, Department of Administrative Services, down to some state agency or some public agencies where it's just the city clerk doing their best to make a procurement decision. So it's broad in scope. As Representative Girard mentioned, it's also broad in coverage. Not only does it cover this PIN that he talked about and the public improvement contracts, but it covers everything that we buy, nuts and bolts, paper to aggregate. It covers building construction, highway construction. It covers the acquisition of information technology systems, which is very significant, I believe. So it's very broad in scope in what it covers. The types of contracts it tries to address are also broad. Public improvement contracts for building, so building roads. Public works contracts that relate to the maintenance and repair of those. The supply contracts that we have. At any level, it actually addresses those, whether it's just one pencil or a gross of pencils. It covers trade services or services contracts, and then it covers personal services contracts in kind of an odd fashion. And why I say that's an odd fashion is because as it relates to state agencies, it tells state agencies that their contracts are covered and DAS must set methods for selection, source selection of the public, the personal service contractor. When it comes to public agencies, they may set procedures. So It's got a variety of different contracts. There's a policy statement in the front of ORF 279 that came about, I think, in maybe the last 15, 20 years, which suggests that, in fact, it says that competition as it relates to public procurements, not including public improvements, should consider elements of quality and the ability of the contractor to deliver the product and really kind of move to a best value sort of approach. However, if you read through the remainder of the chapter, it doesn't really deliver on that policy. It doesn't really give you any tools to tell you how to get there. It is fundamentally, and I guess this is the core tenet of any public procurement policy, and certainly it is the state of Oregon. It's contained in 279.015, and it says that public contracts will be competitively bid through a proposal or an invitation to bid. The proposal language was added fairly recently. The bid language has been around for a long time. And when in a bid scenario, and Chair, move me along if I get too much detail here, but in an invitation to bid scenario, the basic tenet is that you put the solicitation document out and you award to the lowest responsible bidder. Responsive, in our terminology in current statute, we talk about it has substantially complied with all the requirements of the bid. So the bidder must say, I will give you exactly what you ask for. I'm not going to make any changes at all. It's going to be the color you specified, the poundage you specified, or do whatever it is that you ask for. I'm not going to take any exceptions. And you award, just binary system, yes or no, you award based upon the low bid, nothing else. So as long as they're compliant, you say, low bid, that's it. Years later, recently, they have added in statute, the legislature added to this policy, the ability to do competitive proposals. But what they did when that happened was they simply went in where it said invitation to bid and said, for competitive proposal. There's nowhere in the statute that it really gives much guidance then on how you evaluate and how you award on a competitive sealed proposal. We've all heard about, we read in the paper that this bid has been awarded or somebody has responded with a bid, and sometimes it confuses bids and proposals. But a competitive sealed proposal, or what's oftentimes called a request for proposal, is where, generally speaking, where an agency comes out and asks, they say, these are the kinds of things that we need to have taken care of. They ask for various firms or contractors to come back and give written proposals, usually based on evaluation criteria that's set out in the solicitation for the proposal. So we would say that we will evaluate your proposal. 25% of it would be based on cost. 25% of it would be based on the quality of product. Maybe 50% of it would be based on the qualifications of the people who are going to deliver that service. The RFP process is a very effective tool for things where the bid process doesn't work. If you're buying commodities where everybody understands what that specification is and it's that binary system, either it's there or not there, then it works pretty well. But if you're buying systems or system development, or you want to evaluate qualitative factors in addition to cost, or get to that promise in the front of policy that talks about best value, then you have to use a proposal process. So our statutes that currently exist references proposal process, but it really doesn't give a whole lot of guidance around it, and it just simply set it right on top of that invitation to bid platform. 279.015, again, what I believe to be the core piece of this public policy expression of the legislature, talks about some exceptions. And in these exceptions, I'm not going to hit them all, but I'm going to hit the main ones. It says that it doesn't apply to contracts between agencies. So if there is a contract between Department of Human Services and Multnomah County for some health services, that agency contract wouldn't be competitively bid under current law. It doesn't cover products with disabilities or of disabled individuals to the extent that those contracts are entered into in accordance with the back section of the statute, 835 through 855. So that exemption is put into not competitively bidding them. It also says that there are other certain exemptions that, and here's the exception rule, that can be exempted from competitive bid when a local contract review board, so if Portland forms a local contract review board or Multnomah County or any political subdivision forms a contract review board, and then that local contract review board can make an exception to going out to competitive bid, or for state agencies, the director of DAS. So those two entities have the ability to allow for something not to go to competitive bid. The threshold requirement in statute is that, and I'm going to summarize this, but it's basically that it can't be, provide for undue competition or favoritism in the award. So you've got to look at that and say, does this adversely impact competition? If it does, then it can't meet the test for an exemption. And then you have to, the second test is, will it save cost to the contracting agency? So will the contracting agency save cost under this exemption? So if it meets those two threshold requirements, then an exemption from competitive bidding, whether it's a school district or Multnomah County or Portland or DAS, can be made under that criteria. Another exemption.
Can I interrupt you for just a minute?
Yes.
Can you just direct the committee to where in statute those exceptions are? So I'd like to take a look at them.
Yes, Madam Chairman, it would be ORS 279.015.
Okay. Thank you.
And I think it's sub maybe F. I'm not sure of the subsection. It's towards the middle of it. There's a lot of narrative in that one particular section of statute, and that's the first thing that I would advise anybody to read when they're trying to untangle current statute. It also exempts contracts, public contracts, under $5,000. So basically, if it's under $5,000, then there's not an application. You wouldn't have to go to competitive bidding. The competitive bid process under current statute is also impacted by some preferences that are expressed in current statute. They're not all in one place, and so it's easy to miss them, but the basic stat, the preferences have to do with recycled preferences or recycled preferences, and there is a litany of preferences involving applying a preference for paper. It is different for public agencies than state agencies, and they're kind of all intertangled. There's a preference for re-refined or recycled oil, a recycled paper, a sub-paper, recycled product preference, a variety of preferences that came in at different times and kind of act differently depending on whether you're a political subdivision or the state. In addition to that, there's what we call the reciprocal preference. That preference applies to all public agencies in the state, and it says that if you're awarding a bid and an out-of-state bidder bids on that bid that has in their state a preference for in-state bidders, then you must apply that preference against that out-of-state bidder. That strategy of preference or reciprocity is fairly common. Probably most states, maybe 30 to 40 some states, have some form of a reciprocal preference where if their neighboring state is going to apply a preference against their bidders, then they turn that around. They don't all read the same. Other states have in-state preferences. State of Alaska, for example, has a 5% in-state bidder preference. So if Alaska bidder were to bid on a contract in Oregon, we would then apply that 5% against that Alaska bidder. In addition to that, we have included in ORS 279 is the foreign bidder preference, which basically says, and it only applies to, doesn't apply to personal services contracts because of a quirk in the definition of public contract. It's defined differently for personal services than it is for other kinds of contracts. But it says that if a product of a local bidder or firm is equal in terms of quality and price and all other things equal, then you will award to a local bidder over an out-of-state bidder. And what that really comes down to in terms of practical application is it's a tiebreaker, because it's very few times that you would have a situation where you would have the price exactly the same, the quality exactly the same, all the other terms exactly the same. And it would apply mostly in a bid scenario where you've got a tie on the bid price. In addition to that, I should mention...
Excuse me. Representative Schaffler.
You're describing a lot, and maybe in your description you might answer my question for me. There's a lot going on here, so...
Yeah.
In this bill, as it exists, and its amendments, as it exists and how it may be rewritten, is there or will there be any change, any impact, any negative impact, take anything away from prevailing wage, language, law, or rates, and or labor's ability to negotiate contracts? And when I say labor, I mean unions.
Yes. Madam Chair, Representative Schaffler, Jessica Harris, again for the record, if I may, there is no change to the prevailing wage section. There were a few instances where we upgraded a term, but indeed, even in that section where we have changed in the rest of statute, contracting agency to mean essentially what public agency used to mean, we have retained, for the most part, the term public agency in the prevailing wage section for the sole purpose of ensuring that every word of that highly negotiated section did not get changed. And so we are continually reevaluating to make sure that no unintended consequences have happened to that. My friends in the labor community, as well as AGC and other management organizations, especially on the public improvement side, took great care not to make any changes to that section, largely because, as we've talked about in the guiding principles, no change was to be made in the public improvement section unless there was complete consensus to do so. And we knew that opening up the prevailing wage section to any discussion thereof would only create and wreak havoc. So we did not open that. We didn't touch it. And further, again, as it relates to contract negotiation, to the extent that there are provisions in here, and largely the only provision dealing with labor negotiation in 279 is a provision, well, there are two. The first provision relates to hours of labor on a contract, and it discusses the fact that if you have hours of labor and additional holidays, et cetera, that aren't provided for in statute, that to the extent that there's a labor, there's a labor contract negotiated, that the contract, the collective bargaining agreement, prevails, supersedes what's in law. So that essentially is what's in place there. Further, there is a provision that deals with public employees' hours, and it doesn't belong in this section of statute. We have retained every word of it as it is, and we've moved it into another section of statute because it didn't belong in here. It had nothing to do with public contracting. It was just something that I think it's one of those things that no one knew what to do with, and quite frankly, there were a number of those kinds of things throughout the statute that we found, and we went and put them in the right place. So to the extent that there was anything to do with labor management, collective bargaining, negotiating, et cetera, we have not made changes there, and to the one issue that dealt with public employees, we've moved it to the right section of statute.
Thank you.
Dugan, please continue, and will you just back up the truck a little, and you mentioned foreign bidders. Could you just elaborate on that a little bit?
Yes, Madam Chair. I can't give you the citation of statute off the top of my head. Maybe one of our attorneys might.
It's 279021.
279021. And it, and I'm paraphrasing that section of statute, but it says that in the event that you have in the award of a bid, the same price, the same quality and delivery, basically all the same terms, then you will give a preference to, I think it says, a product manufactured within the state of Oregon. And we've taken, just to kind of jump ahead, we've taken those preferences and we've put them into one section, and so they don't get lost. So the ease of use, you can go to that section, and they've actually been recombined so that people understand what they have to apply when they're awarding a bid.
Does this also apply to services? Foreign services?
It applies to services. It does not apply to personal services. And the distinction there is that personal services is not defined. How this law defines public contracts in the current statute in different locations in different ways. So it defines public contract at the beginning to mean public improvement, public works, supply contracts and services, and then later on it allows for personal service contracts to be done under rules by the agency, and they have to, under those rules, develop methods for selection. It almost, in my mind, seems to confuse the term between a contractor and an employee to some extent. I mean, it almost uses that term labor, which gets back to, I think, Jessica's point on the hours of labor. I'm advised by the Department of Justice that that initial language went into effect in 1913 and tried to guide the state on how it paid its employees as well as contracts, and it's kind of hung around. So, and I know this is kind of a long-winded way to get back to this, but because of that, what's happened is personal services contract have been defined in a little different way, so some of those things aren't applicable to personal services contracts. And one of the things that isn't applicable is the foreign contractor preference. Because under the section of current statute, public contract is defined in a way that doesn't include personal services contracts. So right now, under the law, that preference doesn't apply to personal services contract. I hope that answers your question, Representative.
Thank you.
Madam Chair, before we move on, I pass this by, if I may clarify that when we talk about a foreign bidder in this instance, we aren't talking about necessarily just a bidder that is foreign, as in outside the United States, say a Canada bidder, but we are also speaking of a bidder who is, say, in Idaho. So any bidder that is not a resident bidder, who doesn't have a residency here and pay taxes, et cetera, et cetera.
So could I ask you, Jessica, so if you have a contract for services for the state of Oregon from Ghana or something, how is that treated differently from Idaho? There is no difference?
There is no difference. If someone from Ghana comes in and wants to provide, let's say you have a bid and that we're buying desks, and there's an Oregon company that's building desks, and there's a company in Idaho that's building desks, and there's a company in Ghana or China that are bidding desks, and they all want to come here and bid on a procurement for Linn County, and they all come in and they're all equal, the bidder from Oregon prevails. But if, for example, if Ghana comes in and they're 10% low and they can get it here on time and meet all the spec, then Ghana gets the contract.
And just to follow up, I was talking more about like telecommunication type services for the state of Oregon.
If I could follow up, Jessica, on that. Madam Chair, members of the committee, Oregon, it's not, you don't see it in existing statute, but Oregon is agreed with the U.S. Trade Representative's office back during, I believe Barbara Roberts was the governor at the time, I don't know the exact date, but in the GATT agreement, the General Agreement on Tariff and Trade, the United States, as all the other countries who participated in that agreement, reached an agreement that dealt with sub-central procurement units and basically said that to the extent that the states agreed to that and signed on, that this treaty would apply to these states, and said that when it came to procurements, and in effect we would be transparent in how we would treat other members of the World Trade Organization as they submitted their bids. So the level of participation at the time that this was taking place, the U.S. Trade Representative was very anxious to get this agreement, and they were making deals with all the states across the country. And some of the states who had a lot of export, like New York, and Eastman Kodak and Xerox and a lot of, they were big proponents of this and signed on in a big way. Other states had a tremendous amount of pressure put on them through the U.S. Trade Rep and signed on to some degree. At the time Oregon signed on, we signed on to the extent that they were DAS procurements, and I think the level of threshold at that time was about $500,000, but it's expressed in international monetary units, and so it fluctuates. And in a nutshell, what that means is that we can't discriminate against foreign competitors. We have to treat them the same way we treat our own competitors, as I understand that agreement. It has never been an issue, to my knowledge, with any procurement since the state has signed on, at least in this state. I think there have been a couple of states that have actually had issues around that. But there was never any revision made in statute when we signed on. And my understanding is because it's a treaty of the United States and that our level of participation is defined under that treaty, then the federal override provision that is in current statute and is in our other statute would kick in. So it becomes, in effect, like we have a conflict between our law and federal government for ODOT project where we're getting federal dollars, then we would revise our procedures to comply with the federal law where the federal dollars involved. Since you asked about that, it's probably a whole lot more than you care to know about. But we sort of wrestled with that, and we actually thought about trying to put it in, and we said, well, it's covered under the federal override the same way as we had, but I wanted to disclose that to you because at some point that can be a problematic issue, and I think if I were a member of the legislature and was unaware of that, I would say, wait a minute, that's the heck with that. But that is an agreement that's been made some time ago.
Thank you. That's fascinating. I have gotten a couple constituent calls over that, so that's why I wanted to find out what was going on there. Representative Rosenbaum.
Thanks, Madam Chair. I'm looking at the definition. I thought I'd take a radical approach and open the old statute. And the definition of foreign contractor says one who is not domiciled in or registered to do business in Oregon. And I would think that there would be tons of companies that are not Oregon-based companies but yet are registered to do business here if they sell things here or have any kind of marketing presence. So it sounds like that wouldn't apply to, I mean, it wouldn't give a preference to just real Oregon companies.
Madam Chair, Representative Rosenbaum, that is correct. There are a myriad of businesses that are registered to do business here and do so. The definition in the new statute, we have gone away from foreign contractor or foreign bidder and have now replaced it with definition of non-resident bidder vis-a-vis a resident bidder. And in that definition, there's requirements to pay income taxes and during the last 12 calendar months, et cetera, and provides more guidance on what exactly those kinds of bidders are. Essentially, the kind of instance that we're talking about here is kind of a, you know, once in a couple of decades scenario in which you got this low bid instance, you had a company come in from out of state that's never done business here before, or doesn't do it often enough to register, and here you are in a tie bid situation, and you go with the working company.
Madam Chair.
Sam Gerard.
If I might add, we had testimony during the interim, and this happened in Klamath Falls, where our city of Klamath Falls purchased some automobiles from an Idaho dealer, to the chagrin of our Klamath Falls automobile dealer. Had this law been in effect, they would have been privileged to go to the Oregon company first rather than having to accept the low bid which came from Idaho. But they would have had a little more room to negotiate on the bid process.
Thank you. I do want to allow time for the counties and the Willamette ESD to testify. So if you could finish up in about 7 minutes, I appreciate that.
Well, Madam Chair, I'd be remiss if I left this topic of preferences to not mention that even though the in-state printing preference, I see Grover Simmons sitting here, even though the in-state printing preference is not a part of ORS 279, this bill didn't make any changes to that. And it would still require that preference to be used any time an award of a bid is made. So I didn't want to be remiss in forgetting that. We haven't dealt with it, but it's still, that's one of them that sets out in another section of statute, but we would have to go get it if we did a competitive bid for printing and apply that preference. I just summarize to say, we've talked a lot about, this morning I've at least talked a lot about that core piece of what I think the statute is around 279.015 and how it deals with bids and the exception process. As you get further through it, there are a tremendous amount of language that deals with, I think, public improvement, largely with public improvement, and it's very difficult, I think, from a supplier standpoint or from a public agency standpoint to navigate the statute as it currently exists and be effective in applying it. I will tell you that it's daunting for our staff who deal with it day in and day out. I can't imagine how on the end where we have a county clerk in a small county or city clerk trying to administer this, how they possibly do that. I think that I'll leave the overview right there. We are willing to talk about and would want to talk maybe at a later time with the committee about what we've done in this section analysis and how we've restructured it. I want to say one of the things that we looked at as we went through this, at least on the 279B side, is it applies to procurements other than public works and public improvement where it seems to be satisfactory. As we looked at the ABA model procurement code, this document was designed in 1977. In fact, we had the fortune in one of our subgroup or one of our meetings to meet with one of the people who worked on this summer. And then it was rewritten in 1999 to update it. There are something like 15 to 17 states that have adopted some version of this and have used this as a guide. And we went through it to see if there wasn't a better practice and how we restructured this 279B piece that deals not with public improvement, public works, but everything else. And so you see a distinctly different method of source selection in that 279B piece that is largely based on what's in the model procurement code, but we've kind of organized it as we've gone through that. And I think that's probably about my 7 minutes.
Questions? Well, I want to congratulate you on all your work. It's obvious that you've put a lot of hours into this, a lot of years into this. I appreciate this breakdown. It makes it a lot more clear for us trying to make sense of all that's going on here. And we look forward to having you back on Monday and going through the sections.
Thank you.
Okay, we have two people left to testify. I'm going to call you both up together. Association of Oregon Counties, John Osho and Bill Leach from Willamette ESD. Good morning.
Chairman Close, members of the committee, I'm John O'Shell, County Road Program Manager with the Association of Oregon Counties. Consider me at this table one of the many people that's been working for many years on this process. For me, this process goes back to the previous job when I was working as the Public Works Director for Tillamook County. This process has been going on that long. Would really like to see this process get through to completion. This does so many wonderful things, and probably one of the things that is most important for me and the people I work with is just what Dugan alluded to near the end. We have so many people who do this as part of some other job, but most of the time they're doing something else. The existing law is so convoluted and complicated and hard to understand, and you think you've got it solved because you went into one section and did everything that section said, only to find out later there was another section 12 pages away that you should have been paying attention to at the same time. Just extremely difficult to work with. So, two messages to you this morning. The first one is just that. We really would like to see this get through because it is a vast improvement. The second thing is, and it's related to what you're going to have to do in order to do the first one. There was talk about the process we went through. There was talk about everything we did to try and keep it neutral. There were a lot of things that had to be not covered as part of this bill just because we knew they were so contentious. They were so important to so many people, but they disagreed. And part of what we did all the way through this process is we'd work an issue for a while. We'd try and solve it for a while. And eventually we'd say, hey, if we can't solve it, we're just going to leave the language like it is, that gets solved in another arena other than this bill. And I guess that is my request to you. I mean, we've put this together. We've done the best we can. It is just impossible to believe that we've got it entirely perfect, and I'm sure you're going to see a lot of stuff brought before you, many of which you can still continue to keep cleaning up the process. We expect that to happen. But if something starts to get contentious in front of you, where you really see two sides of an issue coming at you, And the inclination is going to be to try and solve it, but I think there's just going to be too many things coming at you, and I would suggest and advise and request that as the issues become contentious, please try and move those and suggest that the people who are dealing with the issue deal with it in a separate bill and move this bill back to original language. Thank you.
Good advice. Thank you.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Bill Leach. I represent Willamette Education Service District here in Salem, Marion Polk, and soon to be Yamhill counties. I wanted to contribute my voice, first of all, to say that I, as with 20 years excess of 20 years experience as a facilities manager for public agencies in this state, most of that time in school districts, with the exception of a seven-year stint here as the director of facilities for the Legislative Administration Committee, I am absolutely overwhelmed with the volume of work and the effort that has gone into this consolidation. I think this bill is, the work that has gone into this is absolutely phenomenal. When I originally saw the Legislative Council draft back in December on this bill and went through it, it was impressive. When I look at the proposed HB 2341, I do see some changes. Still, the bill is incredibly impressive. I wanted to talk to you briefly about a program Willamette ESD has in place that we thought initially might be affected by this bill. And if, in fact, that was the case, it would be a significant policy change. And that has to do with public improvements and exemptions for public improvements. Willamette ESD has organized a consortium approach to providing facility support services to school districts. That consortium approach primarily benefits small rural school districts. Our effort is to obtain for small school districts the same economies of scale or leverage in the marketplace that are enjoyed by the larger school districts in the state. And if you expand that to other agencies, I think the same concept would apply to small fire districts, small police districts, small cities, etc. What we do is we partner with private sector contractors in a variety of professional service areas and labor areas, trades areas, and we offer their services to school districts through intergovernmental agreement at reduced rates, gaining for the school districts an incredible economies of scale approach, while gaining for contractors, hopefully, a steady workflow. That was the initial concept. When we saw in Section 103 the deletion of exemptions for interagency agreements and agreements with the federal government, we saw that as a potential disruption in what we thought would be is a pretty remarkable way to expand limited educational resources in today's market. And we've got a proven track record that demonstrates clear savings for districts in this process. After listening to the testimony and reading the law more carefully, the proposed bill more carefully, given the fact that we have contract review board opportunities to review what we do and compare our offerings to private sector offerings, we think this is a pretty incredible bill. And I'd like to lend our support as Willamette ESD to the passage of this bill.
Representative Schaffler.
Thank you. Just so I got this clear, you believe this will be a money saver for local governments and their public agencies?
Absolutely.
Good question. Other questions? Well, thank you very much. We appreciate your refreshing testimony. Committee, that I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 2341. And I'd like to tell you that we're going to continue this next week, and my plan is to give the presenters, the House Interim Work Group, about an hour on Monday to begin going through the sections of the bill. And I'd also like to provide time for public testimony for about an hour. So we'll be trying to do these concurrently, going through the bill, getting feedback, and we'll be doing that for several days. Is there anything else for the committee? Well, thank you all for your attention and your interest. We are adjourned.